Racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I will employ an intersectional anti-racist lens to support the racialized community as they exercise their human rights.
I will refuse to be silenced, and I will help others raise their voices against hate.
I will listen, learn, speak up, and take actions.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, CJTM in Toronto, at Montreal's CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we explore the absence of the role of international law in the context of Israel and Palestine on Green Planet Monitor, unpack the effect of the Online News Act on pushing Canadian news habits to the right on the North State, and make the case for fair free transit on Pullback. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism daily, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, Maisonneuve in Montreal, The Grind in Toronto, the NB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 20 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from an April 2021 episode, Habib T. Please host Nashua Khan joins the show to look at what went into starting the CCF, the precursor to today's NDP, in a conversation exploring the working class and socialist response to the Deep Depression and government inaction of the 1930s, and how prior struggles and experiences contributed to the formation of a new party. Now, here's the show.
Makes no difference where I go, you're the best hometown.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
Calgary, you know we love you.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Will.
Howdy.
And Nashua Khan, who is the host of Habib T. Please. Nashua, thank you for joining us here on the Alberta Advantage.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
So in today's episode, we're going to dig into some history about the Canadian left, which is a favorite topic here on the Alberta Advantage. And specifically today, we're going to be looking at the origins of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the CCF, which is the party that eventually morphed into the New Democratic Party that exists today. One of the relatively few claims to left Canadian fame that Calgary has, where we produce the Alberta Advantage, is that it was the location, actually, of the founding meeting of the CCF in 1932. And this meeting took place at the Calgary Labor Temple. In this episode, there's really kind of a range of interesting historical questions that float to the surface when sort of thinking about the origins and the founding of the CCF that we're going to try and think about and think through. These are questions like, what went into this new party? Who were the members of this federation? Was it actually socialist? What did this new party aim to do? the Communist Party of Canada was around then. So what was the role of the CPC at that point? And obviously they were a rival party. So what was the CCF's relationship with the communists? Before we dig into this history, though, I want to start by kind of making a few points about how we view and interpret this history more broadly. So it's really quite common for leftists today to look back at historical formations and set up these historical formations as a kind of rock solid foundation for what one is saying now. And the reason people do this is that it really is much easier to establish a sense of authority if you can say something like, you know, my party or my movement or whatever and I have always been correct and history proves this. And in fact, I'm being faithful to that history by saying these things right now. And in fact, I'm fulfilling the important world historical mission of X. But this is a really rough way to actually like interpret and learn from history because the conditions we're grappling with here and now in reality are very different than what folks were grappling with in, say, the 1930s, which is the time period we're going to be talking about in today's episode. And obviously, there's similarities and lessons to be drawn. I don't want to suggest that like every situation is so unique that there's never similarities or arcs or long-lasting political projects. But generally speaking, I do think we should be wary of drawing these big, sweeping conclusions from the particularities of times, places, and the people that we're talking about, and retconning your own political positions and or identity into the past makes for a very poor historical and political analysis. And then I do have one last caveat about our sources, which is that in this episode, we're going to be drawing largely from James Naylor's book, The Fate of Labor Socialism, The Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, and The Dream of a Working Class Future, as well as a little bit from Ian MacKay's Rebels, Reds, Radicals, Rethinking Canada's Left History. We are, generally speaking, amateur historians here on the Alberta Advantage, with the exception of Roberta, who does it for a living. So if you do have any gripes with what we say, or if you think we should look at some additional resources, please feel free to email us at albertaadvantagepod@gmail.com right after you give us a 5-star review on iTunes and support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. So I'd like to start off with a little bit of context. What led to the 1932 Calgary meeting that founded the CCF?
And as usual, when you want to consider a moment in history, you have to think about what came up to this event. And some important historical landmarks come to mind. So one big one is World War I from 1914 to 1918, where 650,000 Canadians served in the conflict and 66,000 died and 172,000 were wounded, which obviously has a long lasting impact on society and shapes a historical moment so greatly when this many people are involved and know and have loved ones that are deployed, involved, come back wounded or don't come back because they died. And this war caused a conscription crisis in 1917, specifically in Quebec, where French Canadians opposed the conscription, which is not surprising because French Canada often splinters from the rest of Canada politically. And then you have right after that, on the tail end of that, in 1918, the influenza pandemic, also known as the Spanish flu, which many of us have been thinking about again, given the pandemic this year, and the circumstances we find ourselves in again, and the echoes from that incident can be felt now. And the pandemic killed approximately 55,000 Canadians in Canada, most of whom were between the ages of 20 and 40, which again, a society really feels intimately when you lose a segment of society that's young and a working segment of society from the ages of 20 to 40. And we've spoken about the pandemic on this podcast before, but it's worth remembering because of the current global pandemic, what this means for public memory and public imagination, but also kind of public desire for change when this many people die.
Then significantly in 1917, there's the Russian Revolution. So whereas previously the idea of a socialist revolution, of building a socialist society may have been considered a bit of a pipe dream, the idea that communists could actually take over and govern a state suddenly became a very real possibility and radicalized a lot of workers. Moreover, there's also the formation of the Canadian Labour Party in 1917, which ran candidates in federal elections for the next decade. They modeled themselves basically after as the Canadian equivalent of the British Labour Party, and were founded on the initiative of the Trades and Labor Congress of Canada, or the TLC. The TLC would eventually merge in 1956 with the Canadian Congress of Labor to form the Canadian Labor Congress that still exists today. The Canadian Labor Party would end up calling for nationalization of banks and public utilities, expansions of social and labor legislation, although with not much success. There were also independent labor parties operating on the provincial level in several regions, engaged with unions and doing political education.
Around the same time, the One Big Union, or the OBU, also formed in Western Canada. And this is actually Calgary's other claim to leftist fame, which is the One Big Union, which was a syndicalist organization very close to the industrial workers of the world, and who kind of had as a goal basically the idea of empowering workers to organize en masse along industrial lines versus craft lines. They have an initial meeting in Calgary in March of 1919, where delegates of labor unions voted to leave their existing unions and form a new one, the OBU. And in between this March meeting and the official June meeting that actually created the OBU, another event happened, which kind of set their schedules a bit awry. And this is something we've talked about on the podcast before, which is the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike, which lasted in Winnipeg from May to June in 1919, as it says on the tin. And despite what it says, you know, on the tin, it actually wasn't just in Winnipeg. The strike actually spread out across the country. Workers from Nova Scotia to British Columbia actually walked off the job in support of the Winnipeg strikers. And many people who were involved in the Winnipeg General Strike ended up being involved in the founding of the CCF. This is people like J.S. Woodsworth, for example. So this is kind of what is going on, generally speaking, in sort of the labor sphere. Big world events that are happening, like the Spanish flu, the Bolshevik Revolution. But there is also agrarian farmer-led governments in Western Canada. So the United Farmers of Alberta, for example, were elected with a majority government in 1921. They would go on to form the Alberta Wheat Pool and Prohibition, broaden labor rights, among a variety of other things. So this is sort of the stage that is being set in Canada in the decades leading up to the formation of the CCF.
So the 20s, were they actually roaring, folks? While it might be nice to think of an entire decade where everyone was just hitting jazz clubs, enjoying films and radio and drinking booze, but this isn't really what the 20s were like in Canada. Wheat prices crashed by 60% in the few years of the 1920s, meaning bad news for farmers on the prairies. Soldiers returning from war created a surplus of labor. The early 1920s saw about 15% unemployment, though things started to pick up by the mid-20s. And thinking about unemployment is pretty interesting to me, given us being in a pandemic again with high rates of unemployment again. And the defeat of the general strike strategy, along with the reactionary atmosphere that followed it, cast a shadow over the labor movement. This led many to focus narrowly on electoralism. J.S. Woodsworth got elected in Winnipeg Centre in 1921 as a member of the Independent Labour Party. And as many of us know, he was active in the 1919 general strike and had been charged with seditious libel for quoting the Bible. He was released after a few days and charges were never filed. It's also in 1921 that William Irvine gets elected as MP for Calgary East as a member of the Dominion Labor Party. He was a Unitarian minister and had participated in the Calgary actions of the 1919 strike. Many workers thought they were living in a revolutionary age, regardless of their involvement in or out of the Communist Party. In the last decade, you would have seen an immensely wasteful conscripted war, a pandemic, a great power monarchy fall and become communist. The Great Depression begins in the autumn of 1929 with the Wall Street crash.
And one thing I really want to focus in on here is this idea that, like, people, you know, thought they were living in a revolutionary age. And this is really interesting to me because it's so different than the time we're living in right now. Like, you know, I was born in the 90s. Like, I was born after the Soviet Union collapsed. I've grown up. I've only ever lived in, like, this end of history, right? Like, I live in a time where there is not only not a sense we're living in a revolutionary age, but instead there is a sense that, you know, nothing is ever going to change. This is the way things are. Change seems like something that happens in other times or other places. So, like, to me, it's really almost difficult for me to wrap my head around what it must have been like to just be like a regular person living in this time period, being like, we live in a revolutionary age. Anything can happen. Like, we could take over the state. The entire, like, country could collapse. Workers could just run the economy. Like, that is something that, you know, I believe, like, I have a moral and ideological commitment to those beliefs. but I don't like, you know, think it's going to happen in the next 2 years. I don't like really have this sense of like, this is all happening around us. And it's difficult for me to understand like that, what that must have done to people's psyches to like be living in a time when not only they believed it, but many people they knew believed it too.
And I think that really contextualizes, you know, the creation of a whole new socialist party or social democratic party that went on to become a major political force in this country. Like we would kind of laugh at that now. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, like, you know, we're not seeing the left-wing politics we want to see. Well, let's create a party. It's like that's not the kind of political imagination that we generally have nowadays.
There was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase in your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2016, Green Planet Monitor features news and stories on global environment, development, science, and social justice issues. Hosted by longtime Canadian public radio journalist David Kattenberg in Amsterdam. On this highlight from a new episode, David speaks with ex-UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Michael Link, in a conversation unpacking the collapsing role of international law in the context of Israel and Palestine. Now, here's David.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, Earth Systems, Human Development, Justice, and Science. Today, a conversation with Canadian law professor Michael Link, former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the territories occupied by Israel since 1967. It's a dreadful, dreadful situation, as I think everybody who watches and listens to the Green Planet Monitor or pretty much any other web news source knows. 19 months into the conflict, they say that an estimated 55,000 Gazans have been killed, with maybe another 10,000 under the rubble. But we're increasingly seeing the number 200,000 appear, as many as 185,000 or 200,000 may have died since October 7th of 2023, directly killed by U.S. bombs and missiles, or indirectly as the result of disease, starvation, lack of access to medical supplies, and so on. Israel is now talking about totally emptying out the enclave, encouraged by Donald Trump, and a ceasefire is nowhere to be seen. Meanwhile, mayhem in the occupied West Bank, where people are being forcibly transferred, and various quote-unquote refugee camps in places like Jenin and Tulkarm are being leveled, totally bulldozed, gasified, the Israelis say. And then, you know, beyond Israel's extra official borders in Lebanon and Syria, Israel is just routinely launches assaults, drops bombs, assassinates people, so on and so on. So with me to talk about this is Michael Link. Michael Link is a known to you all, emeritus professor of law at Western University in Ontario, and the former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. He served in that capacity from 2016 to 2022 and is now retired. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me back again, David. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
I've painted a very dark picture.
There's no sugarcoating this. This is a very dark moment with respect to the fate of the Palestinians. It's as bad, or if not worse, than what they faced in 1948, 1949. But it's also a dark moment for the rest of us. It's a dark moment with respect to morality in the world, that the nations of the world, and particularly the global north, has immobilized in order to be able to intervene to prevent this genocide. And it's a dark moment for something I hold near and dear, which is international law. Israel, through the conduct of its war, its genocide in Gaza, has set fire to international law, and the United States has provided the petrol and the match for that.
And we've talked about this a lot, Michael, this huge chasm, gulf between Israel's actions, Israel-USA. I refer to it as a single entity. Israel and the United States, in my view, are kind of like conjoined twins, so I refer to them as one, Israel-USA. The gulf between their actions in Gaza and the crimes that have been committed over the last 19 months and international law and what they are allowed to do with complete impunity, total and complete and utter impunity. And it's shocking and it's horrifying. And aside from the horror of the crimes and the horror of the impunity, is the horror of realizing what the world is. Like, what does this say about the world today? That in the world today, really, international law counts for nothing.
Well, I would hope I can offer glimmers of hope with respect to both where the world is heading, but also with respect to the durability of international law. But you're right, with respect to Israel and international law and the aid given to it by the United States, there doesn't seem to be a red line that can't and won't be crossed with respect to the conduct of this war. We know from interviews that are now being undertaken with senior foreign policy advisors of the Biden administration that there were very real concerns raised by more junior officers when the time was coming, this time last year, as to whether or not the United States was legally obliged to end its arms shipments to Israel because of the very real evidence that war crimes may have been committed, crimes against humanity may have been committed through that time, and also in the background, the specter of genocide being committed. And we know that the U.S. has laws, and including in particular the Leahy Law, which prevents America giving sending weapons or providing military assistance to countries that are credibly alleged to have been involved in violations, serious violations of international law. And we know from these discussions and interviews that are now taking place that the senior officials in the United States State Department at the National Security Council were pushing back against the memos and draft reports coming from below and rewriting them in order to be able to continue to have America send military aid and weaponry, advanced weaponry, to Israel in order to allow it to conduct that war. And that's why, in fact, there's been suits raised with respect to the complicity of senior American officials with respect to genocide. This will be looked back upon in years to come as an extraordinary failing in the institutions of international diplomacy. It exposes the weakness in the judicial enforcement of international law, and it obviously stains American foreign policy and will for a long time to come in ways that perhaps are going to rank with the way in which America conducted its wars after 9/11 and the way in which it conducted the Vietnam War in the 1960s and the 1970s. All of this, I think, stains U.S. and in the eyes of the rest of the world. But it also speaks to, you know, the divisions within the rest of the global north, particularly with respect to Europe, and its inability to have any coherence in its foreign policy towards one of the most vital issues that's very close to its front door. And we have the interesting spectacle of this past couple of days of comments made by the former foreign policy mandarin for the European Union,
Josep Borrell
of Spain, who now says this is a genocide. I only wish he had the courage to be able to say that while he was still in office in 2024.
And meanwhile, like today, these last couple of days, the leaders of the most powerful European states, Germany and France and the UK, they're meeting and they're telling Putin, if you don't stop your war, if you don't initiate a ceasefire, we're going to slap the toughest, most comprehensive sanctions on you. And yet, no one talks about sanctions against Israel. There's been talk about, you know, not renewing or suspending the EU-Israeli special agreement, cooperation agreement. And there have been proposals to actually do that. And I gather they're going to be meeting in Brussels to decide on whether or not to do that. But it seems like an open and shut case. They should sanction Israel, but they're not gonna.
Keep in mind this, that Israel is a relatively small country of 9 to 10 million people. It depends heavily on the international community, the global north, both for trade and investment, but also for diplomatic support as well. In many ways, it is much more vulnerable than Russia is with respect to maintaining productive international relations. So a decisive act, either by the global north or in particular by Europe, that would greatly diminish its relationships, its trade and investment relationships, and its diplomatic relationships with Israel, would have an extraordinarily impactful result upon Israeli political decision making and the way in which it's conducting this particular genocide. And yet none of that, as you indicate, is occurring. Israel has had now a virtually cost-free occupation for almost 58 years. And the occupation can only continue, and the occupation can only deepen, because it's facing virtually no meaningful pushback economically or politically or diplomatically from the global north.
And the occupation has been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice in its advisory opinion from last July, and the UN General Assembly ratified that and said, you know, a couple of months later, and then said Israel's got a year to end its occupation, and so the occupation has been declared illegal by the supreme judicial body of the international community, and yet the European powers, Canada, certainly the United States, continue to extend aid and assistance to it.
Yeah. Here we are almost 8 months into this 12-month deadline for this resolution that you mentioned that was passed overwhelmingly in mid-September, giving Israel 12 months to end completely and fully its unlawful occupation and withdrawing all of its 740,000 or so Israeli settlers from occupied Palestinian territory. There's been not one single step taken towards that by Israel. Indeed, when Security Council Resolution 2334 was adopted in December 2016, it said that the Israeli settlements are a flagrant violation under international law. It told Israel it had to completely evacuate its settlements, and it gave gave a direction to the Secretary General of the United Nations to report every 3 months to the Security Council on steps being taken by Israel in order to comply with Resolution 2334. There have been 33 quarterly reports issued by the Secretary General to the Security Council since the beginning of 2017. Not every single one of those 33 reports says that Israel taken no steps at all to halt settlement construction, let alone to start to unwind its massive settlement enterprise in the occupied territories. So with evidence like this, that Israel is a bad faith occupier, that it is conducting, as you said, an unlawful occupation, in the words of the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, and that it faces no meaningful headwinds with regards to this. The question then becomes the complicity of the global north, and particularly the United States, but also Europe as well, in maintaining this situation has now led to, you know, what the world sees live streamed every day and every night as this ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Israel needs to be forced to end its war on Gaza. It needs to be forced, and it needs to be forced to end its occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. And it's hard to imagine the United States forcing it, although the United States could. Biden could have. Biden and Blinken could have forced it. Forget about prevailing on Israel or pressuring Israel. I always enjoyed hearing in places like Al Jazeera or CNN, the U.S. is just trying.